16 to 1, a podcast about education, teaching, and learning.
Hello!
Hello!
How are things?
Things are good. Things are great.
Fine.
I'm trying a different thing this week. I'm trying
positive.
Lack of truth. They're great.
Oh,
it's great.
That's fun.
Things are wonderful.
I like lies, so yeah. This is really good for that.
Well, I just wanted the intro to sound different from how it sounded for every episode since March.
So
I was like, yeah.
Are you saying we haven't been very positive?
I'm gonna try untruth today.
Untruth.
No, they're good. You know, we're getting in the back to school spirit. How do you feel about that?
I feel really good about it.
Yeah.
I'm also practicing the same thing that you are.
Untruth.
Untruth.
We are practicers of untruth.
I have decided that it's going to happen, so I might as well, you know.
It being the resuming of in-person instruction.
Yeah.
Are you ready to cram 26 kids in your 10 by 12 room?
It's fewer than that.
Okay.
It's like 20.
Oh, okay.
I think maybe 19, actually. I don't know. My numbers are, they have moved some kids around to make the classes smaller.
That's good.
Yeah. But my room is small on a good day, so it's just going to be a little bit more of a challenge. You know, but like going back to school has brought up all of these things. That's like, I don't want to take my water bottle from home there and bring it back home every night. So I'm like, you know what I mean? I'm like rethinking a lot of
like your lunchbox. I don't.
I mean, I'm sure a lot
normal
of people...
everyday like how you function at an adult job kind of stuff.
I just like, do I want to take my water bottle back and forth every day? I don't really want to. You know, kids are gross. Kids are gross before a pandemic. So. Teenagers especially.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm just figuring out a lot of those types of things, you know. But we'll figure it out. Why are you laughing at me?
I feel for you.
Thank you.
Because I still get to work from home. I feel very lucky that I do, but
I keep talking about it.
I'm
happy that you get to as well. I think it's a lot of our friends who don't work in education have been told that they will be able to keep working from home. And I think that's good. I think it's important to keep as many home as we can still.
Yeah.
Especially just since, you know, things aren't quite where they need to be yet.
Right. I think it's kind of going to be interesting to see how this changes. I mean, it's already doing it. But changes the attitude toward big office buildings and being...
Yeah. Well, I was like,
physically in the same place in cubicle.
Yeah. I mean, we know a few people who've already been told that they'll be working from home through the year, like through the end of 2020.
Yeah, I've heard some that are already going through like summer of 2021.
Yeah, I think Google was one of them.
Yeah, there are some big Silicon Valley kind of type companies that are just being like, well, you know what? We're just going to be remote until at least 2021. And then we'll see from there whether or not we even go back to the office at all.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard of... Actually, I know at least one person who's just been told that they're never going to return to an office.
Yeah.
And that their work really can be done online.
Yeah.
Like, you know, virtually, like from wherever they
are. My thing with office buildings has always been, and again, like, I don't know, if I had a different kind of job, I might feel differently about this. But at least in the tech and coding world, I can collaborate pretty easily with. And I had to do a small team, so that changes things a little bit too. But I can collaborate pretty easily online, and I just never found any of the offices I ever worked in to be comfortable places. Mm-hmm. And I do my best, most focused work when I'm just physically comfortable. So that's the one thing that I'm kind of, I mean, obviously that is, you know, kind of down the ladder of things that managers and people care about, but like it just I don't, and it's different for everybody because some people do prefer to work in an office building together, but for me it's always been like air conditioning and lack of comfortable seating. Like I always freeze in the office and I'm always just, it's just not a comfortable place, you know. You feel like you can't kind of just get even physically comfortable in a space where you're working. And so I'm kind of interested to see what evolutions take place in the whole attitude of having to occupy an office building.
Yeah, I am. We listened to that. Was it 99 PI where they talked about concrete?
Yes, concrete.
And so ever since that episode of
99% Invisible, yeah. It's another podcast that we like to listen to. And they,
it's Roman Mars who does it. But there was an episode all about concrete and the way that the world is sort of shaped by our need of it and like the necessity of it. And so ever since then, I just look at some of these things and I'm like, we didn't need to use that concrete for that. Like, you all could have sat at home and done this. And, you know, so that also kind of shaped my view of this. But now that so much of the world has been forced to work remotely, mm-hmm. It's pretty evident that we've wasted a lot of really good space with buildings we really didn't need.
Yeah. Yeah. I say that especially like, when, yeah, big school buildings that look like prisons for some reason. That's like the chosen architecture for a school design in the United States. They look like prisons, schools, which should tell you something about our attitude towards schools, but, and prisons maybe, I don't know. But yeah, just big buildings just sitting empty, like big strip malls. You know, I'm just looking at all these buildings. I'm like, oh,
well, yeah, strip malls concrete. Are a whole other. Being in Ohio, that's like our home and native language is a good strip mall.
It's an abandoned strip mall.
no, I just, that episode really made me think about, you know, the space that we literally use for that kind of thing. And how once we've done it, it's not reusable in that way. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. It's just, yeah. So that made me already be more aware of the concrete that's used. And then also on top of so many people being able to work from home, it's kind of just been like, well, why weren't we doing this before?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, mm-hmm. Here we are.
It's just like a big, you know, it can really reduce the sort of pollution footprint too for various mm-hmm. reasons. We're not commuting. We're not, you know.
Yeah.
Spending money to heat and cool office buildings mm-hmm. or not. Just think of all of that.
Yeah.
All the possibilities.
And
there.
I've been reading about school districts who are talking about, you know, like this upcoming year is going to be more costly in a lot of ways, either because of needing devices or other measures that need to be handled in school that would cost more. And some of the articles I've been reading have said that with the school shutting down, they were able to save the money. You know what I mean? Kind of in like last spring to help mm-hmm. kind of offset what the costs. And then, I mean, schools aren't in a great place anyways, funding wise, obviously. But
hey,
maybe we should stop defunding education. But, you know, I don't know. There's so many moving parts. It's very complicated. But
mm-hmm.
here we are doing it. And a lot of people have already gone back.
Schools and a lot of people have already re-canceled.
Colleges have already canceled again.
In-person instruction after like a week.
Notre Dame?
Notre Dame just went back to remote learning because they started in-person classes and then like 150 people got coronavirus and a staff member.
University of North Carolina as well. I think it was their main campus.
A bunch of public school systems are experiencing the same thing.
Yeah. So we'll see.
We'll see how
anyways,
it goes.
Here we go.
So what are we talking about this week?
We're talking about dyslexia.
Dyslexia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In all of our info, most of the info on the top, at least, is from the Mayo Clinic.
Yeah, the Mayo Clinic.
Which I had been pronouncing incorrectly maybe the twice in my life I've said it out loud.
Because you didn't want to say it like the condiment?
I never thought they would actually be the Mayo Clinic. I thought they'd be the Mayo Clinic.
I see.
But I listened to a lady on YouTube yesterday say it.
I think it's because you're prejudiced against mayonnaise.
I don't like mayonnaise, so I'm probably just trying to get away from it.
Okay.
So what's dyslexia?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of familiar to pop culture, at least a little bit. People kind of generally think they know it and what it means, what it is. But it's a learning disorder that involves difficulty in reading and speech, processing language generally. Due to problems in, like, you know, identifying speech sounds and learning how they relate to letters and words. And that's called decoding. It affects brain areas that process language. And there's generally no consensus in the medical community as to how exactly it happens. Sometimes it can even actually result from a traumatic brain injury, so you can acquire dyslexia. Mm-hmm. It's called acquired dyslexia. So obviously it has something to do with these brain regions that process language, but we're not really sure how it happens or where it comes from. It does seem to be genetic, Yeah. There seems to be
a lot of times
genetic proclivities for acquiring dyslexia. So there's no cure for it, but early assessment and intervention tend to result in the best outcomes for kids. Although it's also true that if it's not treated early, then that those problems tend to persist for kids.
Yeah. It's one of those things that it seems, I mean, based on the reading and my experience, that the earlier that it's found within students, like, I mean, they're just able to get more help. You know what I mean? Like, that's what's so important about it, is that many times the teachers who catches it, and, you know, especially like early ed teachers are, you know, they're great at finding or noticing these types of things in their students. But as soon as they can identify it, it's usually best just to go ahead and start getting them the reading support or the speech support or whatever it is, just to try to help them, you know, try to learn, because they're not going to, you know, get rid of it ever. Like you said, like, it's not a curable thing, but they are going to be able to learn all types of skills and things like that that help them. You know,
there are ways to manage it.
Yeah,
there's no cure, but there are ways to manage it and make it easier for people with dyslexia. So what are we talking? Just like sort of like signs and symptoms.
So the first part is sort of the symptoms. And so like what it could look like for a child under five, like what type of things they might be showing that could be a clue to them being dyslexic. And then as it goes up through school age and then adulthood. But I think one of the most important things about dyslexia is that the severity varies from person to person with it. So I've had students who told me like towards the end of the year that they were dyslexic, and I had no idea. It hadn't been disclosed to me. I had no reason to ever, you know what I mean, question it.
Mm-hmm.
And those were students who had been diagnosed at a pretty young age. And so they had already, you know what I mean, kind of gotten to the point where they knew what worked for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, I had
more tools to manage.
Yeah, exactly. And then I've had students that told me day one that they had it, and it was because they had only found out in like middle school. And it was because of how horrible they were at math, basically, is the reason one of these students found out. So it was kind of on me to figure out what would help them, but we were able to make it work. So I've seen, you know, some pretty opposite ends of that range as far as what the severity can look like. But so if we're talking about kids younger than five, like before school age, some of the symptoms or the things that may key in a parent or someone around the child to know that they might be dyslexic is like if they learn to talk really late, like later than what would be considered normal. They might be really slow or slower to learn new words. They would normally have problems forming words correctly, so they might reverse sounds in words or confusing words that sound alike. And they have problems remembering or naming letters, numbers, colors, like just like the sort of simple things that a four-year-old would be able to do. And they might have a hard time remembering a nursery rhyme or learning it or even to play a rhyming game.
Hmm.
I used to always screw up Dommy and Maudie. Remember that? I think I might be dyslexic. Do you remember my parents telling you that? I could not keep them straight when I was younger.
What are you
saying? I would try to say mommy and daddy, but I would say Dommy and Maudie.
Oh, no, I didn't know.
This is all coming back to me now. And I had some problems with, I had to have speech help when I was in elementary school.
Because
I'd tell my dog to go shit instead of sit. And I had an aunt shoe. I really did that. I forgot that I used to call them Dommy and Maudie.
I had an aunt shoe too. In case
well, you're smart though. So that's just something that I was kidding. But no. I just thought of that. We can cut that out. But that just occurred to me because that's exactly what they're talking about.
Interesting.
Reversing sounds and words are confusing words that sound alike. So for me, I kept switching. I knew it was mommy and daddy, but I couldn't get it. What if I just diagnosed myself at 30? What am I going to do now? I'm 30. What am I going to get it from it now?
We're doing this. Neither of us being medical professionals. We're live diagnosing one of the co-hosts here on the podcast.
Anyways.
No, but that's an interesting possibility. I mean, I think that's, as we were researching this, that's something that kind of stuck in my mind, is that it would be easy to miss it. Or think that it was something else, or just think that, like, oh, they just have trouble with this one word. Or, like, it's hard to, unless you really have a trained eye and you're paying attention to it, it can be difficult to catch.
Well, and I'm thinking, like, for like, school-age students, right? And this is, like, normally school-age kids are where they are finally diagnosed. Like, the number, you're more likely to be diagnosed once you enter school, is essentially, you know,
because there's standards against which.
Right. And so for parents at home, like, it's a little bit harder, except if you compare them to their sibling or to the neighbor or to, you know, whatever. So for school age kids, though, it's it becomes more obvious if they're reading well below the expected level for their age, if they have problems processing and understanding what they hear, if they have difficulty finding the right word or forming answers to questions. They might have a problem remembering a sequence of things. And this one's really interesting, a difficulty seeing and occasionally hearing similarities and differences in letters and words. And I think this is one of the most stereotypical keys, right, to dyslexia. It's when they flip letters, like mm-hmm. a D and a B or something like that, or P and Q. Like, mm-hmm. those are usually the letters that I feel like, I don't know, like when I was learning about dyslexia in education, I feel like that was what I learned, mm-hmm. that they would flip letters or numbers or right. something like that.
I remember when we learned about this a little bit at Teachers College, there was like, there was some like gross textbook, but it was kind of interesting because there was like an attempt to depict mm-hmm. to people who weren't dyslexic what it would look like to
for those
read.
That were.
A dyslexic patient. It looks like kind of a scramble of parts mm-hmm. of letters, all like weird.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can just do some Googling on that, listeners, but it is kind of interesting. And again, we have no way of knowing for sure that that's what it looks like
right.
To people with dyslexia, but like there are some kind of interesting, at least, you know, a way to imagine what it might be like to try to read. And again, I can understand why certain fonts would be more difficult to read. Mm-hmm. It's like what you were saying, because you kind of flip letters that look similar. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it can look like, at least these examples of what it's supposed to look like, it looks like just kind of somebody took a bunch of scissors to
yeah.
letters and cut up parts of them and then scrambled yeah. them all together.
Well,
it's
and
really interesting.
The other important thing about people with dyslexia is that many times their eyesight actually, like, they're not actually impaired visually.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not because of poor vision that the brain, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, their eyes are actually,
right.
I mean, they could, you know, have corrective lenses or something, but the sight isn't what's causing mm-hmm. it, essentially, mm-hmm. is the point. Mm-hmm. So just a couple other things for school-age kids. Difficulty spelling, inability to sound out pronunciations of an unfamiliar word. So they wouldn't be able to pull out the vowel sounds or something like that to piece together how we would teach other students who are reading to try to pull together mm-hmm. a word they hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
They might take a really long time to complete tasks that involve reading or writing, and it could just be because they have to keep rereading it over right. and over because they're not comprehending it. And
that one is difficult, especially for teachers and parents of like sort of younger school age kids, is because it would be easy I think to get frustrated with a student because it seems like it could seem like everything else makes sense to them, and
yeah.
there's just this one thing. It's like, do they just not like this mm-hmm. subject or something,
yeah.
or like whatever it is? But it requires a lot of patience because they, you know, kids with dyslexia don't know how to express that that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
They just like, it's just maybe takes more time for them.
Well, and
maybe.
I would have to assume that. I've never been in an early ed classroom except for like 3 days of substitute teaching, which doesn't count. But I would think that they would. A teacher or a parent working on, you know, trying to help their student, they would probably start with things just like reading comprehension, and they wouldn't immediately go to maybe their dyslexia. You know what I mean? Like, I would think that maybe we would start by saying maybe this is a level that's too much for them and they're just not there yet. You know what I mean? Like, I think that we would start,
right.
you know, reasoning into other things before we go into,
that's
oh,
the
it could
problem.
Be dyslexia.
That's the problem with dyslexia and why it's kind of difficult to diagnose sometimes is because you can be just, like, absolutely brilliant in like, other, like, ways that don't involve decoding or language processing or something.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's confused, like, what's possibly going on. And, like, there are kind of these prejudices that say, oh, well, my child can't have a learning disability because they are so smart about this,
mm-hmm.
this, and this. But it's, like, it doesn't have to do with your intelligence, really. It has to do with just the way that you happen to be, the way that your brain is doing
yeah.
the intake of the visual kind of signs of language.
And
I think
then,
it can be auditory too, but it's
yeah.
it's just that processing part. It doesn't mean that there are, you know,
oh no, it's not a reflection of intelligence
there's not,
at all.
And there's not, and it doesn't even mean it has to do with understanding, because you can mm-hmm. understand words and phrases and sentences perfectly well, but still not be able to process
yeah.
a sort of level of intake and output, I guess.
Yeah. And so for teens and adults, I mean, these things keep compounding, right? So we're still going to have problems with reading or reading aloud. We're still going to have a really, really, it's going to take a long time for them to do intensive reading and writing. They're going to have a problem spelling. They're going to avoid activities that involve reading. And I see that a lot in the classroom, kids who are not as confident as read aloud or something like that. And that could also just mean that they're not as confident, but it could also be because, you know, maybe some of them are mm-hmm. showing some dyslexic tendencies and haven't gotten that support. A lot of them.
I was just going to say, that's a thing we just need to be aware of as educators. Like, maybe that kid isn't, you know, they're not raising their hand, not because they don't want to participate, but just because it's like mortifying mm-hmm. to not be able mm-hmm. to do it at the level that you think you should be able to, for a reason that you don't entirely understand as a kid. You know, it's just like the pressure there. It would be nice if, you know, we could just kind of go at those kinds of situations with a bit of sympathy rather than just assuming somebody's trying to get out of doing work or something like that, because it can be, that would be terrifying. Like, for me, that would just be, if I were facing that, that would just be scary to not be able to do what I feel like my brain should be able to do.
They might mispronounce names or words or have problems retrieving them. And this one's really interesting because one of the other key signs for a teen is that they have troubles understanding jokes or expressions that have meanings not easily understood from a specific word. So like an idiom like is a, you know, life is a piece of cake, meaning that, you know, like it's easy. Mm-hmm. So some of them can't catch on to those types of things.
Idioms and expressions involving tricks of language.
Yeah, or like just these kinds of phrases that we use. Again, they'll probably take a longer time to complete a task that involves reading or writing. They'll have difficulty summarizing a story. They'll have trouble learning a foreign language. They'll have difficulty memorizing.
Self-diagnosing again.
Yeah, I'm still self-diagnosing. They'll have difficulty memorizing, and they'll have difficulty doing math problems. And that's another, I mean, math, we see the same kinds of problems by switching numbers that look, you know.
Yeah, there's a thing called dyscalculia, I think it's called. Where it's like a similar thing to dyslexia in the world of math, I think.
Something separate then? Or similar? Or the math version of it?
A disability resulting in difficulty learning or comprehending arithmetic, such as difficulty in understanding numbers, learning how to manipulate numbers, performing mathematical calculations, and learning facts in mathematics. Sometimes informally known as math dyslexia.
Huh.
Interesting. So there are other, you know,
variations.
There are variations of this. There's one sort of focused on the auditory processing more, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, really what you see, though, is that it's compounding, right? Like, all of it from the early age to school age to teens, adults, whatever. Like, we're going to keep seeing the same kinds of things. But the unfortunate part is that, obviously, the longer that you go without having the support of a diagnosis, right, to get the kind of, you know, if you need additional time on tests or it read to you or something like that, like those are the kids that I worry about. You know what I mean? Because they've had to work so much harder for so much longer at something that they couldn't help.
Mm-hmm. So, like we mentioned, there's no known cure for it. But if you see any of these signs or symptoms, it's kind of useful in your kid, or, you know, even if you're a teacher, if you're in a position to have a conversation with parents about some of these signs and difficulties, it's worth it to have a conversation with your doctor about it, just because, you know, it's worth it to get help as quickly as possible. The support that kids need, the sooner they can get it, the more they'll feel in control of something that's really not their fault that they have to deal with. So,
didn't you say this was the most commonly, what did you say it was? Dyslexia was the most common?
Probably, I think I read it was the most common learning disability.
Okay. So for students like that, if they're identified, then they can get supports in school as well for things like read aloud or additional time. You know, all the things that could really help them succeed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what causes it?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about how it tends to be genetic. It runs in families. Again, nobody's really sure as of right now, but it appears to be linked to certain genes that affect how the brain processes reading and language. And there are also environmental risk factors, like a family history of dyslexia, like we talked about, or other learning disabilities is a risk factor. Premature birth or low birth weight, which I think was interesting. Exposure during pregnancy to nicotine, drugs, alcohol, or infection. They can alter the brain development in the fetus, which makes sense because those things can also cause tons of other problems. And then individual differences in the parts of the brain that enable reading, which is very vague. But again, nobody really knows exactly what causes this. So
the most common complications, obviously, of dyslexia. I mean, most importantly, maybe not most importantly, but one of the key indicators is the trouble learning. These reading skills are basic to most other school subjects. So a child with dyslexia, right, is already at a great disadvantage for all the other classes that rely so heavily on it. It can lead to social problems. And I think, like, this is something I've definitely seen, because this can lead to low self-esteem, right? Or behavior problems or anxiety or aggression and withdrawal. Like, if we have kids who aren't confident readers and writers and learners and things like that, like, that definitely is reflective in the classroom. And then they're also at a greater risk or an increased risk of having ADHD. And so ADHD can cause difficulty sustaining attention as well as hyperactivity and impulsive behavior. And that would make then the dyslexia even harder to treat. Mm-hmm. And so it's just...
I mean, all of this makes sense.
It does.
When you consider that it'd be such a difficult thing to have to be dealing with, especially for younger kids. But it makes complete sense to me that there might be behavior problems and aggression and anxiety that have to do that, because it'd be so frustrating.
It would be very frustrating.
You could see all your peers around you doing this thing, and you're like, why can I not do this thing? And you don't know how to express why you can't, you know,
get it.
Process at the same rate that they can. So you get this cluster of other behaviors that are possible for especially undiagnosed dyslexia. It's, again, it's just another, really got to hand it to educators for having the patience to know to deal with all of these things, because you're not only, you know, the teacher in this case, you're also trying to help people diagnose medical conditions, because you're the one who's in the position to
catch
it. Say, hey, maybe you should go to the doctor now, because this is what I'm noticing.
So I think what's most important, especially with the focus of this podcast being education, is to talk about what teachers can do. And there are big things, there are little things, obviously, but there are kind of two ways to break it down. You can talk about things that involve the materials that you use as a teacher, and then the success in the classroom itself, so how you run it. So the materials that can help somebody who's been diagnosed with dyslexia to be more successful is, the first thing is to clarify or make instructions really simple. You want to underline or highlight portions that are most important for students. So even if that's on, like, I use my smart board a lot to project things. And sometimes I'll put, like, you know, kind of our goals for the day. That would look like just highlighting the key things so that the student...
I was going to say, that'd be useful regardless.
Yeah, it would be. But these are just, you know, some... that's
like
fair.
Even for students...
Maybe I'll just do that in general.
Who don't have dyslexia.
Sure.
Like, highlighting the important parts would be a useful thing.
Yeah.
Maybe. Also for adults.
Yeah, for me. It says to present a small amount of work. And so you either want to give them portions of a handout or break it into pieces so that you're not giving them, like, a 3-page assignment that's going to overwhelm them with a ton of reading or even a lot of math problems. And they said that even for like math teachers, what they can do is they can, like, literally take their sheet and rip it in half and give them the 4, you know, questions at the top and
so
let them go,
like,
through that.
It's just like a wall of text.
Yes.
Cutting down on that.
Yeah.
The sort of
And
imposing...
so if you're eliminating the things that they're having a hard time already, you know, digesting in their brain, then it's going to give them a more concentrated look.
So it's not even just like you don't have to come up with a special word for them or anything. You just have to present it in a way that is
just
more accessible.
No, they do say that, like, you should provide them additional practice before mastering, but as far as, like, the actual handouts, no, it seems like you could just, you know, for many of them at least, keep what you already had. Huh. It says you should block out extra stimuli in handouts. And so if you can use larger fonts or more evenly spaced, that would help them. But I mean, especially if you get on, like, teacher pay teachers or whatever, you know, some of these people really like to get very detailed. And sometimes it's just too much. Like, less is more, especially for students with dyslexia. You should try to provide them with additional practice activities. And so normally somebody with dyslexia will require more practice before mastering something. A glossary of terms has been proven to help those with dyslexia because it gives them the big bold words that they need to focus on. And then that way they have easy access to kind of what they're working with. A reading guide, it can be really good for them. So you could do it page by page, section by section, or paragraph by paragraph. And I see that being really helpful maybe in, like, a science or a history class. Like, if you're talking about, you know, like, for history, if you're talking about, like, the American Revolution, you know what I mean? Like, you could do it by month or something like that, depending on how you're doing it. But that would help them summarize it, because summarizing is something that they are not as likely to be able to do on their own, or it can be more of a challenge for them. It says that an audio recording device can be great. So if a teacher would be able to record what they're presenting to the class and then provide it to them, that then the student with dyslexia could go back and re-listen to it and pause it and you know what I mean, kind of go through it that way, and that can be really good for them.
Chance to put things together in the proper order.
And then assistive technology is great for them as well. So if you have a tablet, an e-reader, a dictionary, a speller, text-to-speech programs, all of those can be really, really helpful for them, just because it takes the pressure off of those things, you know what I mean, and it allows them to kind of get that support more readily available than even the teacher having to sit and do it for them themselves. So in the classroom, though, it looks like it's pretty simple. Like when I started kind of listing these things, I think a lot of teachers are already doing them without even realizing it.
They're doing accommodations without necessarily knowing.
Yeah, just because that I mean, one of the biggest things that people with dyslexia say that they need is to have repeat directions. So even if you think you've said it 8 times, 2 more times will help. You do want to establish daily routines, because people with dyslexia thrive on a routine because they know exactly what to do when, and then that means that they're having to do less with their brains to figure out what needs to be happening next. You should always try to provide a copy of lessons or notes, and so this is something that like I should work on, because normally I'll post or I'll show like the slide at the front of the room, but I won't always email the kids a copy of it, so that could just be something easy to kind of work in for myself. Graphic organizers help them because it helps keep them kind of in line with what's happening as it's happening in real time.
What is a graphic organizer exactly?
Graphic organizers a lot of times are like fill in the blank of notes or something like that. So it kind of lays out what's happening in front of the students, and they can work with it as you're getting to it in class.
Gotcha.
Step-by-step instructions are really helpful for them. You should try to combine verbal and visual info. So if you're just standing at the front of the room talking, they're going to have a harder time remembering what you're asking of them.
I mean, same.
Yeah.
If keywords, you're just standing and talking at me, I'm not going to remember things very easily, probably.
Yeah. Having keywords on the chalkboard or your whiteboard, you have to balance the work. So give them a chance to work with others. Give them a chance to work on their own. Give the whole class a time to work together. Like,
people, and then this is so that they don't get pigeonholed into a kind of activity that they're not good at.
Exactly.
Right? Or that they and feel that they're so not
that
they're, good at.
That they're able to learn from other students, and that they're able, the other students are able to learn from them as well, which is important, because a lot of time people with dyslexia have, like we said, like social anxieties and stuff.
Yeah.
So if we give them the chance to work with other students,
it's to overcome the feelings of isolation that can come with knowing that you're different somehow, but not being able to put your finger on it and being frustrated in that. So.
And just a few more things. You should try to emphasize reviewing daily. And that's as simple as you as a teacher saying, what did we do today? What did you learn today? And kind of having the students think back about, okay, why do we do all this? Like, what was the greater, you know, goal of it? If possible, you should try to put students who have dyslexia closer to your table or wherever you spend time during class, just so that way you're at an easier reach for them, and maybe they won't feel quite as uncomfortable to raise their hand or, you know, something like that. And then just allow really flexible time for them.
Yeah.
So give them the time that they need. And you can look at a kid and know if they're working or not. You know, so it's kind of on the teacher then to say, hey, I know this kid. I know they're working their butt off right now. They're just having a hard time. Like, you just have to be willing to, you know, to work with them. I'm glad that we did this, because I've never thought so much about dyslexia in this way, aside from just like knowing what it is.
I just think it's a really difficult thing to diagnose sometimes. I had some friends. Who I know they had a school age kid, and he was having some troubles that they just really could not identify very easily. But I think there's some of this like ADHD stuff involved in it too, and they were just like really struggling to figure out what was going on with him, because he's this really smart kid, and he just didn't like to read, for example,
right?
You know, and they're like, what is going on here? Like, he's so smart about these things and blah blah blah, but he just doesn't like to read and don't want to do it. And they're like, maybe he's dyslexic. So you know, and it's like, but it can be very difficult to diagnose, because it can also have completely, you know, there's a huge kind of spectrum of how like level of sort of the impairment with identifying letters and reading and stuff like that. So you can have really mild forms of dyslexia and then really intense ones. So it's not an easy problem. And this really does kind of, you know, open up a lot of possibilities for parents who might be struggling to identify what's going on with their kids in school. And, you know, and I think that just the main thing here is just to sort of approach things with, just be sympathetic, you know, approach things with sympathy and realize that not every kid who is maybe not doing the work at the level you think they should be or that you want them to be, they're not necessarily doing that on purpose. No. You know, like they're not doing it to annoy you. They're not doing it to be lazy. Mm-hmm. They're doing it because it's just the way that they're the rate at which their brain works.
It's true.
So anyway,
it's yeah, I mean, like I said, and I'm about to start year 8, and to my knowledge, I've only had, I think, 5 that I have either been told by, I, you know, like, whatever was servicing that student or from the student themselves that they had it. And I'm sure I've had more. But some of these things are just really easy to work into your classroom anyways, even for students without, you know, diagnosed dyslexia, mm-hmm. obviously. But I just think it's so important because if we're, when so much of our world revolves around reading, you know, mm-hmm. I think it's really important that we're supporting them.
I mean, that's the really difficult thing about dyslexia is that it's not just like your, okay, when you're in elementary school, it's not just going to be like your mm-hmm. spelling tests and your reading scores that are going to be bad. Right. Because reading is the gateway into everything. Achievement in every single subject area. So,
well, yeah, and even just life. Right. I mean, you have to read forms. You have to read agreements. I mean, you have to, you know, like, that's what's, I think, most troubling about this is that if these...
You have to doom scroll through Twitter. You have to...
Yeah, but I mean, even to get a car or to, you know, like, there's a million things that you would have to be able to comprehend.
Right.
So, anyways, important things that teachers can be doing. Easy things, most of them.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these things are good for, you know, other any kinds learner. Of learning. Yeah, learning sure. disabilities, too, especially, like...
I agree.
Like, kind of attention issues and, like, ADHD and... stuff like that. A lot of these things can be helpful in approaching those issues in the classroom too. Yep,
for sure. Okay, you want to do last week's question?
Yeah, fill in the blank. So last week's question was, Jean Piaget, a Swiss psychologist known for his work on child development, had published multiple papers on blank by the age of 15. And what was that?
Mollusks. Obviously.
Which I found extremely hilarious. I don't know of why. Course. But it was just like... multiple papers on mollusks by the age of 15. Good job, Piaget.
Of all the things, that's, I mean, the
I'm
one.
I'm just, like, imagining this, like, little kid who's, like, you know, like, going out in his backyard to play stickball, and he gets distracted by some mollusks and decides to write some papers on it. It's just like, what is going on in this kid's life?
Just mollusks.
Who is poor Jean Piaget, and why did his parents not let him have any fun?
Maybe that was their fun.
Mollusks.
Okay, so this week, I went searching for famous people who've been diagnosed with dyslexia.
Right.
Okay, so that's where this question is coming from. So, we are looking for an American director and producer, just as a little heads up for the, you know, for those playing at home. And for one friend who told us yesterday that he always tries really hard to get it right, and he's never gotten it right. So, aww. He might get this one. Let's hope for him.
I bet he'll get this one.
Yeah, he should be able to. We just talked about it. So, this week, the question is, this famous American director and producer with dyslexia has won 4 Primetime Emmy Awards, 7 Daytime Emmy Awards, and is most known for having created the first ever summer blockbuster in 1975. That movie earned $60 million in its first month. So, who is that American director and producer?
Cool.
It's a lot of money and a month, man. Okay. Any other things you want to get to before we
talk
about what we learned this week?
I'm ready to talk about what we learned this week.
Okay, go ahead. Tell us what you learned.
Okay, well, we stumbled upon this
I don't know
whole
how this happened.
Genre of entertainment that is hilarious to me. We were just, like, you know, flipping through channels at the end of the night. We watch a lot of streamer, you know, on like esports kinds of streamers, and just for easy viewing or whatever, and a lot of times they're very humorous, but we came across this one random one, and we started watching it, and we're like, what is going on here? And this guy gets on his stream every day.
He's on right now
as we record this. He records himself for our entertainment scamming scammers. So he calls people who do things like, you know, leave a phishing voicemail on your phone being like, oh, you're in trouble with the IRS. And if you don't call now, your social security number will be destroyed or whatever it
made
is.
Made public in the newspaper.
So he does. This guy, his name is Kit Boga. He goes by Kit Boga, but I'm sure there are other people who do this too, yeah. But we were watching a lot of this one guy because he's really funny. He sets up entire personas and gets into character. Mm-hmm. He has a voice changer, so he sounds like it's often older. He often makes mm-hmm. himself sound older because these people tend to target older folks. Mm-hmm. So he makes himself sound older. Sadly. He sets up virtual machines, so he because often these scams involve them, the scammer will connect to your computer or will do some doodly doodly magic on your computer or whatever, or lock you out of your computer.
Or lock you out of it completely.
Or try to get into your banking information. Yes. So, like, he sets up virtual machines, so he has entire, like, you know, different setups for each of these personas mm-hmm. that he connects to remotely, and then the scammers connect to him. And his whole objective is to waste as much time as possible
of theirs,
for these scammers. So he has a timer that he runs when he connects and calls these people, mm-hmm. and the objective is to just run up as much time on the timer talking to these scammers as he possibly can. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, what he'll do is often, like, they typically try to get you to buy gift cards and then tell them
give them the code. Yeah.
So they do this thing where they, like, pretend to give you a refund for a service that you never really signed up for. They'll be posing as Microsoft or something. This is like the tech support scam. Mm-hmm. They'll be posing as Microsoft. They'll pretend to give you a refund for an extra zero. So it's like a $400 refund, and they'll type in an extra zero at the end. So they're like, oh no, I gave you $4,000 instead. My boss is going to fire me unless you go buy gift cards.
And give them back to me.
To make the balance right. So, okay, mm-hmm. So they never actually gave you extra money to begin with. That's all a scam. And so the end of the day, the object is for the scammer is to get you to go get gift mm-hmm. cards and read them the code so they can redeem your yeah. money that you... never, you know, it's your money,
but so, you put it on a gift card now.
But it's just hilarious. So this particular guy who scams scammers, he'll tend to redeem them for himself at the end, which makes them absolutely livid. The scammers
have to watch.
Freak out. So the scammers are just watching this guy redeem the gift cards that are supposed to be redeemed by
$2,000 in gift cards
yeah.
and stuff.
And this is after, like, sometimes, like, after 16 hours of phone conversation with them, because this kid is, like, able to draw out the conversation with the scammers long as possible. So it's extremely funny. I mean, just the level of, I mean, dedication to that craft of scamming scammers is really, like, all the personas, all the voice changing, all the remembering mm-hmm. details of your personal life that you've completely made up over the phone. So it's a... We fell down that rabbit hole.
He fake call his grandson. It's just, it's amazing.
Yeah, that's another thing he'll do. He'll call himself. So he'll be playing, he'll be talking to a scammer on the phone, and then he'll patch in himself as a third mm-hmm. person. So he'll be doing two different voices back and forth to himself on the phone with the scammer. It's really creative and really funny. And I think it's really cool. He started doing it because his grandmother had Alzheimer's, and she was dementia,
like,
maybe
something like
she kept falling prey to these people mm-hmm. who would call her up and be like, "Oh, your tech support, this is Microsoft tech support," and it's not. And she would,
but she's worried that she's actually done something.
Right, mm-hmm. right. It's very scary. They
it's
act
horrible.
Like you're gonna go to jail if you don't give them gift card codes. And yep. so, especially for older people or, you know, whatever. Anyway, he got into that because of that reason. I just think it's really cool. I mean, it's, you know, it's a very entertaining mm-hmm. pastime to watch scammers being scammed. Mm-hmm. So
it really is.
Yeah.
That was a great thing to find. And his YouTube videos are great. If you don't have the time to commit to his live stream, he does create YouTube videos of the calls that are like the better ones. And so some of those are kind of short and they're really fun. But it makes me feel better because I get so mad that people just do that.
Yeah. It's really infuriating that people prey on people, especially vulnerable populations.
And especially, that's what makes me the most upset. I was Anyways, check on your elderly folks in your life and make sure that they know that if they think they're getting scammed to call you, you know, to help them. Anyways, okay, what did you learn this week? This is on topic. I actually made it relevant, which is not normally the case.
I think this actually might have been the reason why we did this episode.
I think this might be it. So Instagram is one of my favorite social platforms as far as, you know, social media goes. And so recently they've updated their story option, which is part of the Instagram experience. And so they added different fonts to Instagram stories. So you can post a photo, write on it, type on it, whatever. Mm-hmm. They added Comic Sans. Uh-huh. Instagram did. the font Comic Sans, which I have just not liked for a very long time. It has just made me crazy.
Graphic designers do not like it very much, speaking from my realm of familiarity.
It just makes me crazy. Mm-hmm. And so I've always kind of given, you know, my coworkers or whoever uses it. One of my friends is an elementary teacher and she loves it. And so I just can't stand it. It makes me crazy to look at. Mm-hmm. So I found on Instagram, somebody shared this because they were talking about why we should be using Comic Sans. And it's an article, I'll include it in the show notes, but it's from The Cut. And the title of it is called "The Reason Comic Sans is a Public Good." So I read it because I was like, fine, convince me. So long story short, it's a great font for people with dyslexia.
Interesting.
It's because many fonts reuse letters and flip them, like a P flipped to be a Q. This is especially true for like Times New Roman, which is my go-to. Uh-huh. But that's how the P and Q works for Times New Roman. It's the same thing, just flipped. This is really hard. This is one of those things that can be really, really difficult for people with dyslexia. So the variations in the letters in Comic Sans and the spacing has been proven to help.
Interesting.
And so there's a quote from there. It says, quote, to wit, Comic Sans is recommended by the British Dyslexia Association and the Dyslexia Association of Ireland. So if you're a teacher, you find yourself wanting, you know, to help your dyslexic students, it really can be just as easy as highlighting your entire handout and changing it to Comic Sans.
Interesting. I know that there are other fonts that have been specifically designed.
But Comic Sans came up because of Instagram adding it. And so that was kind of why everyone was like, please stop using it. And I was the same way.
It's interesting.
But Comic Sans, if you're not familiar with it, you should Google it. It's not a very pretty font. That's just my bias. But it's really well spaced. And the letters are pretty bold on their own. And so they don't naturally get really close to each other. And they don't use the same letters to flip like a P and a Q or something like that. Like, they never do those types of things. Mm-hmm. And so that irregular shape of Comic Sans is what makes it such a great font for people with dyslexia. Because they're not going to see the same shape used, just in a different way. So... I've been...
Well, it's kind of interesting because, like, this font, Comic Sans specifically, was supposed to be used for younger audiences.
Yes.
And, like, informal, goofy documents and stuff. But part of where it comes from, the name especially, is, like, the inventor of that particular typeface was, like, kind of modeling a font off of comic books that he had.
Yeah.
So it comes from, you know, it's, again, usually targeting a younger audience. I mean, not that adult people can't enjoy comics as well, but just that, you know, it's targeting a younger audience. So it kind of makes sense why, you know, especially with when dyslexia tends to be diagnosed and such, that Comic Sans and other fonts are good ones. Like, they're specific fonts that are built for the purpose of making it easier for dyslexic people to read.
Yeah, sorry. I was just checking. The B and the D aren't the same either. So that's the other thing that's... See what I mean? They are different. So it's not just flipped. It doesn't look like. Mm-hmm. But anyways, those are like B's and D's, obviously. P's and Q's flipped. Like, the Q is actually much different than the P, but maybe the B and D are the same.
No.
Actually, they don't look
like curves.
Yeah, I think the D is more curved. But anyways, the goal essentially is for, if you have students with dyslexia, you want to find a font that doesn't reuse letters, just, you know, flipped.
I'm guilty of just crapping on Comic Sans indiscriminately because I thought it was ugly, but I was not being sensitive to the fact that it could just help people read more easily.
I've never had to think about those things, and so I'm happy that this is teaching me to be more, you know, aware, because sometimes I use some kind of fun fonts because I think they're fun, and maybe I shouldn't. Like, now I'm starting to rethink that maybe some of these are not as fun as I think they are.
Yeah.
So I should probably be more considerate of these types of things. But so anyways, if you're looking for a dyslexia-friendly font, Comic Sans is the one.
Cool.
There's a cat screaming for help outside
our door. There is. I think we better go rescue her.
Well, if you're going back to school soon, be safe. Take care.
Be healthy.
If you are a teacher, may the odds be ever in your favor. Mm-hmm. If you're a parent, be kind. Be patient. Schools are working really hard. Teachers are working really hard. Everyone's trying to make this work for everyone. We're trying to be safe. We're trying to be healthy. We're trying to pretend things are normal for you. So, you know, have some grace. And we will as well. See you next time.
We'll see you next time.
Okay, bye.
listeners, thanks for supporting 16 to 1.
We're trying to grow our audience, so please check us out at 16to1.com, all spelled out, and tell your friends about the show.
On our website, you can find links to follow us on social media, an archive of all our old episodes, and a contact form where you can get in touch.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next show.
Why am I singing that song?